Gary Nall. We're broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, we take an important topic that generally is not discussed with any seriousness in the mainstream media, and we explore it with experts. Today, the plight of the honeybee and other essential pollinators. My guests will include Dr. Neil Carman, a chemist and biologist who is a scientific member of the Sierra Club's Genetic Engineering Committee that researches and assesses the evidence of genetic engineering's impact upon the environment and animals and plant life. The Sierra Club has also joined forces with the Center for Food Safety in its lawsuit against the EPA to suspend the use of different types of insecticides. Neil holds a doctorate in botany and has been active in environmental causes in Texas, including air quality control. And in 1992, he started to work with the Sierra Club and is now a leading voice on issues of genetic engineering, industrial chemical agricultural practices, and the role of technology and toxic chemicals on the environment. The website is centerforfoodsafety.org. Then we have Larissa Walker. She is a policy and campaign coordinator at the Center for Food Safety in Washington, D.C., a national nonprofit public interest and advocacy organization promoting the protection of human health, the environment, and to protect the public from harmful food technologies by promoting organic and sustainable causes. She did her postgraduate work on a small organic farm and has been an active person in agriculture, energy, and environmental issues at local and state levels. She is currently a point person for the center in its litigation against the EPA for its negligence in addressing the evidence of the different pesticides that we are going to be challenging, the dangers of these pesticides on the nation's bee population. Again, the website is centerforfoodsafety.org. And finally, we have Steve Ellis. And Steve Ellis is returning to Minnesota with his bees after pollinating almond groves in California. And he'll be on a mobile phone when we speak to him in his truck. And Steve is a commercial beekeeper and owner of the Old Mill Honey Company in Barrett, Minnesota. He has over 2,300 hives, and this year he's witnessed a dramatic decline in his bees. He is among four major beekeepers who are plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the EPA for failing to protect America's bee population. And that's our panel. I'd like to welcome all of you to this program.
Thank you, Gary.
Good.
Thanks, Gary. Happy to be here.
Thank you. And I should let this audience know, those who are not aware, that I am also a certified organic farmer and a beekeeper, and have done research on bees and organic farming and different forms of farming since 1972 with the Fertile Earth Research Farm upstate in New York, and continuing on to this day with my farm down in Florida. This year has been the worst year for bee health, and as a result causing bee death and hive collapse. Last winter, the die-off was as high as 50%. Since 2004, over a million hives have collapsed across the United States. 7 of 10 crops grown in the United States rely on pollinators, which include our almonds and other nuts, oranges, peaches, cherries and blueberries and strawberries, avocado, soybeans, and much of our cotton. 75% of global crops require bees. Commercial beehive operators pollinate 1/3 of U.S. crops, and 80% of flowering plants rely on pollinators. The bee industry contributes over $15 billion a year to the economy. We're going to begin with you, Neil. I've identified 5 contributors to bee death in the literature, some that are touted by the big agri industry as well. The USDA's bee research lab at Beltsville, Maryland, found there is no single cause for hive collapse. The Varroa mites that invade hives and feed off bees, parasites, including funguses, cell phones and towers, electromagnetism is known to interfere with bees' navigation, Terminator seeds, these genetically engineered seeds include pesticide gene sequences and pesticides and herbicides, the most dangerous one for bees being the neonicotinoids, a class of pesticides that are nicotine-based. And based upon your research and knowledge of the subject, would you prioritize these threats for us in whatever order you feel are contributing most to bee and hive collapse, and any that I have left out, please add in.
Yes. I would place the pesticides, number one, the neonicotinoids, because it's been in the last decade that we've been putting these on seed coatings and planting, you know, millions of acreage in the United States and in Europe with these toxic seed coatings. So this is kind of a brand new aspect of what's been happening to the bees, and it has a very relatively close parallel to the rapid decline of the bees colonies, although some arguments from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Department of Agriculture try to claim, along with industry, that there were, you know, collapse indications even, you know, over 10 to 20 years ago. But today, it's in the last 10 years, it's gotten dramatically worse. So in my view, the chemicals are the worst simply because, in summary, they have many effects on the bees. They don't have to kill them outright. They can simply disorient the flying honeybees so that it's unable to get back to the hive. And also the fact that these chemicals are translocated up through the plant into the pollen and the nectar and the water that's exuded onto the surface of the leaves. And so there's many ways that the bees can be exposed. And these chemicals are very neurotoxic to the bees, even at exceptionally low doses.
Okay, we have a bad phone connection with you. I'm going to ask you to hang up. We're going to call you right back. And let's go over to you, Larissa. Larissa, we are supposed to have federal agencies that oversee the health of the environment and foods that are grown. They're supposed to be objective. They're supposed to look for the truth, wherever that truth may lead us. And yet, many individuals, myself included, believe that this is more like the tobacco industry trying to defend that smoking doesn't cause cancer, and as a result continue to promote the idea that people have no fear or should not fear cigarettes, and because they haven't been called out yet. What are your feelings and what's your research show? How well have the American public been protected, and how have the bees been protected from special interests and polluters and industry that have a lot of power within our government?
Sure, I think that's a great question. I think certainly, first and foremost, we can all agree that the bees aren't being protected, hence why we're seeing the worst die-offs this year in history. Beekeepers are witnessing an alarming decline in honeybee populations around the world. And I think here in the U.S., it is concerning that the EPA has allowed the use of these neonicotinoid chemicals, along with various other pesticides. But these chemicals came onto the market pretty quickly in the early 1990s and more commonly in the early 2000s, and through a conditional registration process. And so the assumption was that the pesticide registrants would put forth the proposals for these chemicals to be registered, and EPA would allow them to go onto the market under a conditional registration, presuming in time that within a reasonable amount of time that the pesticide registrants would submit the necessary safety tests that these showing that these pesticides aren't harmful to either pollinators or the environment, other critical species, or even humans. And in doing so, I think we've realized that this conditional registration process is broken, and in fact, we don't have the necessary tests here to show that these chemicals are safe to our pollinators or other species.
A follow-up question for you, Larissa. research for several years has shown that the neonics are the most toxic to bees and hives. In fact, I recently came across a paper that when the honeybee genome was decoded, it was found that bees have only half as many genes devoted to detoxification and immunity as do most insects. So they are far more fragile than other insects and therefore more prone to diseases leading to death. But we have known about the dangers of neonics for a while now, yet our EPA, against even the warnings of its own scientists, have done nothing to ban either the pesticides or to lessen its use. Other countries have banned it, including Germany, the home of Bayer Corporation and the leading manufacturer of neonics. Give us a background in detail into the use of the neonicotinoids. What products are they found in? Who are the primary manufacturers of this insecticide? And the science proving their neurotoxicity and the politics behind why we continue to permit its use and, in fact, are allowing it to be increased in American agriculture and home lawn and garden products. However, I want to ask about the lawsuit against the EPA separately. So don't talk about the lawsuit. We'll get to that
sure.
in a little bit. All right.
Sounds good.
But take
sure.
your time, because we have a lot of people who have known nothing about this. So I'm sure you're so used to giving kind of brief insights, but we really need the full story told. And that's what makes
right.
this commentary area important, because you will not be interrupted. You have all the time you need to answer the issue.
Great. Well, thank you. Sure. So the neonicotinoids are a class of systemic chemicals. They were first introduced onto the market here in the United States in the early 1990s. And the first one to be introduced was a specific chemical called imidacloprid. And it's a neonicotinoid chemical commonly found in backyard garden products. That's what a lot of homeowners would find in products they can buy on shelves. And after imidacloprid was registered, we saw the introduction of a few new neonicotinoid chemicals, primarily clothianidin and thiamethoxam. And those are used as seed treatments, and that's used widely in commercial agriculture. So, for instance, corn, about 90% of all of the corn planted in our country is reportedly coated with a neonicotinoid seed treatment. And as you mentioned, these chemicals are extremely concerning, and it's primarily because they're the most widely used insecticides now in the world, and they have extreme persistence in the environment. They can accumulate quickly, and they are water soluble. So this raises a slew of additional concerns about the adverse impacts that these chemicals might be having on aquatic invertebrates or birds and other beneficial insects separate from honeybees and native pollinating species. So we've really seen these chemicals. I mean, now we have reason to believe that there's about 90 to 100 different products, neonicotinoid products, on the market, and a lot of them have gone through this conditional registration process with the EPA. So they're certainly widespread here. With respect to what's going on internationally, you mentioned Germany is one of the countries that has taken action to suspend the use of neonicotinoids. So has Italy, France, Slovenia, Austria, and most recently Sweden. All these countries have taken some sort of precautionary measure, which we've applauded, and they've suspended or restricted uses of these neonics out of concern, not just for bees, but also broader ecosystem impacts. Here in the U.S., right now, the two companies that produce neonicotinoid chemicals are Bayer and Syngenta. You'll see them hold the largest market for these chemicals here.
A follow-up question for you. WikiLeaks released documents showing that our State Department under Hillary Clinton had been threatening countries that they must take our genetically engineered seeds, and if not, there would be a price to pay. And we would not have known of this form of extortion if had it not been for WikiLeaks' release of them. So given their own way and not being pressured, I wonder how many countries would actually use something that was destroying their bee crop and hence adversely affecting their base economies. And what does it say about our government and its manufacturing associations when our government is used as a viable tool for them to force countries to carry toxic products?
Right. I think that's a good question. There's definitely reason to be concerned, and that's why, you know, we urge countries to take the precautionary approach. You know, we wish that the EPA would do the same here, but unfortunately they do not. Recently, in January 2013, the European Food Safety Authority issued a stark review of the risks that neonicotinoid pesticides pose to bees, concluding that exposure from pollen and nectar were only considered acceptable to bees on crops that are not attractive to them. And I think that study played a large role in pushing the EU to consider this two-year ban on certain uses of neonics. That was what recently went to vote in March of 2013. So unfortunately, two countries abstained from the vote, and hopefully it's going to appeals now, and we're still hoping that the EU can come out in support of a two-year ban on neonics. There's certainly reason to be concerned.
I wouldn't be optimistic because I saw how the European Union treated the scientist who found that there were serious health problems in the laboratory animals that they were using in long-term feeding of genetically engineered crops and seeds. And the political pressure is financial pressure behind the political pressure is anyone who says anything negative about genetically engineered anything is to be marginalized, ostracized, criticized, and their reputation destroyed. So I haven't seen any great courage in the European Union in standing up for those scientists willing to do independent quality research on the long-term impact of pesticides, genetically engineered seeds. Let's go back over now. We have Dr. Neil Carman on the line, and we'll go to Steve Ellis in a moment. Neil, I didn't have a chance for you to finish describing, and I'd like to really have you describe why cell phone towers and cell phones and Terminator seeds and herbicides and the other possible causative factors, either individually or collectively, are causing the problems with colony collapse.
Well, I think that these are definitely potential contributing factors. Once the bees are exposed to even the low concentrations of the neonicotinoid chemicals, then their immune system is greatly weakened, and then they can become much more susceptible to disease and death and injuries by the attack of the virus and the other organisms. Okay, cell towers, the electromagnetic radiation from the cell towers is quite significant, and the Environmental Protection Agency has looked at some of this information, but unfortunately the problem with the EPA is that even if they get pretty good information, they're really not taking action. The EPA is waiting until 2018 to really decide what to do about this problem, and we can't wait that long. So I think it's a complex issue, but I believe that the neonicotinoid chemicals have risen to the top of the target list of what's at the root of the whole problem. And the EPA pesticide division has a long history of seeming to be more in favor of the industry it's supposed to regulate. You can go back into the 1980s and 90s and many controversies with the EPA Office of Pesticides of approving way too many harmful chemicals that are harmful to humans and harmful to wildlife and the environment. And EPA has been very, very slow over decades to, require stricter testing and regulations of these, of all sorts of pesticides. And so this is really kind of an indication of a broken system at EPA, that the pesticide regulation is a fraud. It doesn't work. And that's, I think, a major factor in the problems that we're seeing with the collapse of the beehives around the U.S.
Some common sense is needed on this issue, Neil. Many pesticides work by disrupting central nervous system activity in insects, and yet we do not then consider what the impact would be on a child, for example, that consumes products made that are sprayed with pesticides. And we know now from the science of nanotechnology that in tiny parts per billion, very tiny amounts, it can have biological effects. So do you know of any evidence showing neonicotinoids' adverse health effects on humans, and particularly children?
There is some preliminary evidence that's coming into the literature, and it's just that there's not a lot of these kinds of studies in terms of either epidemiological surveys. You can't really do that kind of human testing. I think another challenge here, in my experience, is that there's over 100,000 industrial chemicals in production today, and it's a huge Pandora's box of exposure that people are dealing with. So the CDC, since the mid-90s, has been doing body burden surveys of 1,000 people at a time and finding literally 100% of the American population that they test in their blood and body and liquid samples show pesticides, metals, organic, synthetics from plastics. And so there's a real challenge in trying to, even if somebody's exposed to neonicotinoids in the low part per billion range, I would expect they're going to find many other chemicals from the diet, from all the other exposures. So it's a very difficult area to, investigate and try to point the finger at a single group of chemicals.
Well, that was also true for cigarettes. For 100 years, not a single lawsuit brought by any claimant was won because the actual science couldn't prove it. And the only reason that the industry ever lost was because they were found having lied by a whistleblower, and then all 7 of the CEOs of the tobacco industry giants had to come before Congress and acknowledge they lied, and that's where the state settled some $300 billion in class action suits to reimburse Medicaid at the state level. Otherwise, to this day, you would still not see cigarettes held out as the culprits they are and the tens of millions of deaths they've caused. So I don't accept at this moment that we do not have the type of science. I believe as a public health advocate and a person who is in the field that you have to look at subclinical manifestations. When people today who have environmental sensitivities are being tested, you're finding pesticides showing up in their blood, as you said. You're showing heavy metals showing up in the blood. And these people are the canary in the coal mines. Just like a child with autism spectrum disorder, there might have 1,000 children given the vaccine with mercury and aluminum and polysorbate 80 and formaldehyde. And most will not have the adverse effects, but there's going to be some who do. And so when you consider how toxic these chemicals are, I don't believe we should ever be erring on the side of the manufacturer, but rather on the side of the public. We just shouldn't have them. But let's go over and say hello to Steve. Steve is on the phone. Steve Ellis, nice to have you with us today, Steve.
Good talking to you, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here.
Steve, from you, we're going to ask a different question. The average person doesn't know what it's like to live with bees every day, and lots of them. And I want you to take your time. There's no rushing. We have no commercials. And tell us what it's like to have the life of a bee. Take us through what a bee does, how it does it, what the normal lifespan is. where that honey comes from, the queen, let us get some appreciation of the intimacy of the bees and you as the beekeeper and that relationship you have. And then, and only once we really have that background and grounding in bees, then tell us when the changes you started to see happening occurred, how they occurred, and how they have continued to manifest. All right?
All right. Well, let's see how to best explain this for the average person. What I do is I manage 2,300 hives of bees, and I move them in a migratory fashion around the country. And I think maybe an analogy for people would be a shepherd who has a flock that he moves from pasture to pasture. And if you would keep all your sheep right in one spot, they just chew the grass down, have nothing to eat. And we move our flock around so that they have good sources available to them. And they work the various sources in the area, sometimes managed sources, sometimes wild sources. We basically move around and kind of follow floral sources around the country. We kind of chase flowers around and try to provide the best environment for our bees to be able to thrive. And so working with them, it's a very symbiotic sort of a relationship that develops between beekeeper and bee, and it's just almost kind of like a lifestyle develops around that. So it, for a lot of people, it's a very foreign thing to try to understand. But for people who are in the industry, it really is one of the best jobs that you could have, and it's very gratifying to be able to be out in nature and see the direct effects of pollination and your pollinators on both managed crops and wild ecosystems, and in raising productivity.
Explain the life of a bee.
The life of a bee, well, the bee is a super organism, the honeybee that we work with. And as a super organism, there's 50, 60,000 individuals living and working in a very sophisticated fashion together. And they divide up the functions of gathering nectar and pollen and tending to young and caring for the bees in the hive and defending the front entrance to the hive and bringing back propolis so that they can have an antibiotic wash when they come in and rub up against that, and it detoxes them as they come in. I mean, they're very, very sophisticated, elaborate behaviors and mechanisms that they employ as 60,000 individuals working tightly together.
How long do they work? Do you have 24 hours in a day? At night, the hives are dark. Do they work all the time, 24 hours? How long do they live? When do they die? What happens to them when they die?
It depends on the time of the year, the lifespan of the individual worker bees. In the busy season, when they're flying on a regular basis, it can be as short as 3 or 4 weeks. If there is a winter period, they can survive for a period of 4 or 5 months. And so the lifespan varies greatly depending on the activity level and the season and factors like that. They only fly during the day. At night, they're in their hives, and they just come out to defend the front door a little bit if they're attacked or something, but they're inactive during the night. That's when we move them around. We can transport bees at night because they aren't out flying, and they're all back in their hives.
And tell us about the queen bee and the uniqueness of what she's able to do, how long she's able to live, how many eggs she's able to lay.
Well, under normal conditions, the queens can have a longer lifespan. We've been seeing shortened lifespans as one of the symptoms we've been seeing since we've been having problems with the bees. We used to consider that queen bee would live 2 to 7 years. And now if you get one to last for 2 years, you're doing quite well. And a lot of people actually requeen their hives twice a year. And they just don't have the longevity, the vitality that a normal queen bee should have. So they normally are long-lived, but that is part of a symptom of what we're seeing in this compromised state that honeybees have found themselves.
Explain when you saw the decline in hives and the full-on catastrophe of colony collapse.
Well, colony collapse was really first brought to the public attention by a beekeeper from Pennsylvania named David Hackenberg in 2004 and 2005. And it's just a large number, losing a very large number of hives in a very short period of time, have them rapidly depopulate and just be left with either empty boxes or just a box with a queen and a few attendants around her and otherwise empty. And the hive, seemingly healthy otherwise, with plenty of honey stores and plenty of food source available and no apparent reason for having been so rapidly depopulated.
Talk about what a bee does when it leaves the hive. Explain the whole process of pollination.
Well, pollination is really one of the greatest. It really is one of the greatest wonders of nature. Plants and animals develop this amazing symbiotic relationship that benefits both, and each benefits and each has a requirement for the other. So they're intricately tied together. Flowering plants came onto the scene on this planet about 50 million years ago. And Darwin called it the biggest single thing that's ever happened to the planet was the angiosperm revolution, when plants figured out how to become sexual. And to do that by utilizing an animal host to move pollen and cross-pollinate and attract that host by having flowers with colors and scents and a reward of food like nectar and pollen. And all of a sudden we went from 3,000 species to 250,000 species of plants. And these blooming plants that we have out there that are beautiful with blossoms and fragrances and wonderful things, this Garden of Eden we live in would not exist without pollinators.
So what exactly does the bee do when it goes to a plant?
The bee, when it comes to a plant, there are very many specialized pollinators. There's 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 species of pollinators. A honeybee, of course, is the one that everybody typically thinks of. Many flowers are specialized to certain pollinators. And when the pollinator gets to the plant, they go into the floret and by the hairs on the body and the motion of the bee, they attract, and the static charge on the bee, they attract the pollen grains that they contact from the anthers that are out further on the floral structure as they're going down toward the nectaries, which are usually at the base of a flower. And when they get coated with this pollen grains, then they go to a flower of the same species in another area. And the process repeats itself, and the pollen grains get transferred from one plant, one floral head to another floral head by the pollinator host.
Okay. Now, there's also the royal jelly. Explain the royal jelly.
Oh. Well, honeybees have dietary needs. They're a fascinating thing how they've evolved to be so self-sufficient. Honeybees actually make their own construction materials by a gland. They secrete wax on the side of their bodies, so they make their beeswax for constructing their hive. So they make their own construction materials. They also make their own protein source, which is royal jelly. It's a hypophrenal gland secretion that when the bees are raising young brood, it excites the hypophrenal gland to excrete more and more royal jelly, which is the purest protein substance known to man. The bee's diet is short. It has carbohydrates and it has sugars, and it is short on protein. And to correct that deficiency, they actually manufacture their own protein to feed to their young. And that is what royal jelly is.
Okay. It's been revered all over the world for millennia. And it was very popular in the United States as an anti-aging tonic promoted by Bernard McFadden back in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s and 40s. It's lost a lot of its historical significance, and hence its popular appeal today. Now, let's go back over to Neil. Jeffrey Smith has identified some studies that give a strong suggestion that GMO crops may also be contributing to bee and pollinator death. And we know that during this recent epidemic of bee death, Minnesota and Nebraska and Ohio, parts of Indiana, were especially hit, and these are all states that are part of the Corn Belt, and corn has been a major pesticide route for bees. Also, it so happens that the vast majority of corn grown in the United States is genetically engineered BT corn with a pesticide sequence introduced into the corn genome. Now, there are approximately 92 million acres of corn grown in the United States, and 94% of that is non-organic and requires pesticides. Moreover, with growing pest resistance to BT corn, more pesticide is being dumped onto fields. From your perspective, is there any science on the relationship between the GMOs or Terminator seeds and the decline of bee populations?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that it's another area where, unfortunately, the Environmental Protection Agency has done a very poor job, along with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, in evaluating these genetically engineered crops and the environmental impacts that they are suspected of doing. Pesticides, herbicides that are engineered into the crops, the studies are not very well done by the companies that produce them, and so there are some studies, but we probably need more. I know Jeffrey Smith very well, and I do agree with him that these genetically engineered crops may also play a role because of the toxic nature of some of these chemicals. Roundup is very harmful to humans and wildlife, but we still get into some data gaps in terms of being able to make pretty powerful statements. But I agree with Jeffrey and that there are some very good preliminary studies that point, you know, the need for more, and that I think this is a huge problem. You're correct that most of the corn is genetically engineered to be resistant, such as to the Roundup Ready resistant corn. So the farmers can spray a lot of the Roundup Ready herbicide on their crops to kill weeds, but at the same time, there's other inert ingredients in the Roundup, and plus there is some persistence to it. And so I think this is another part of this Pandora's box of toxic chemicals used in our agricultural system that needs to be reined in. But the governmental agencies seem to be very inept at, they don't get a lot of funding for science, and they don't really do a good job of regulation. It's basically a system of self-regulation on the part of the industry that produces these GMO crops. So I agree with Jeffrey Smith and many who see the genetically engineered crops as a major problem in terms of, you know, human health and wildlife impacts.
Thank you. Steve, back to you for a moment. If we continue losing colonies and bees at the rate we're doing, how long before you see that we have a major food crisis in the United States and elsewhere, and especially for those crops that are grown to export to other countries where it may be the only kind of crop that there a lot of people are eating, and what will it do in the United States?
The losses that we encounter do have a direct impact on how long will, first part of the question, how long can we keep on with these kind of losses? People hear numbers like 20, 30, 40. You mentioned that some people have experienced as high as 50% loss. Actually, it is worse than that. Some people this year experienced 80 and 90% losses. The average is probably going to be close to 45, 50. And then people say, well, if you lose 50% this year and 50% next year, you got zero, right? So it's not fuzzy math. What happens is we lose these bees in the fall and the winter, and these losses are fall and winter numbers that we're talking about, if it's 30 or 50 or 70 or 90%. In the spring, bees are quite resilient, and floral sources are good, and you can split the ones that you have that are alive and keep making increases in divisions and make things up. We have an ability to make things up to a certain point in the spring, but many of us who are in the commercial beekeeping industry feel that we have reached the point where if we get past the 50% mark on a regular basis, up to 60 and 70%, this last winter I lost 65%, that unless you have ideal conditions, you're going to be right at the point where you have to stretch everything as thin as possible to get the number back to where you need to be. And if we go, a lot of us aren't able to rebuild. We have to buy bees from other sources to replenish our operations this spring. And many are in that position. So things are stretched about as thin as they can go, and we're at a kind of we've passed a critical tipping point because we were short of adequate strength bees to supply to the almond orchards of California. And how that will affect the actual crop of the almonds in California. There were orchards that went without bees. There were orchards that were very short in numbers of bees. And how that will impact their crop potential it will have to be measured. There's two factors on crop production with pollination. You have the presence of pollinators, but you also have to have weather. Well, this year, the presence of the pollinators was short. It was very, very short. But the weird thing was that the almonds bloomed 3 weeks later than they normally do, and they got into a hot spell where there was no rain and perfect flying conditions for the entire period of the bloom. And so the weather will probably largely trump the shortage of pollinators this particular season on this particular crop. But you can't rely on absolutely perfect best weather ever in the history of a crop every year. Sometimes they just get a few hours here and there for a few days, and the quality of the pollinators has to be maximized then. So we've reached a tipping point, and we went over the edge this year. It won't become as apparent in the yield number for the odd reason that it was an unusual weather year during the almond bloom in California.
But if we continue on and we don't have the best weather, if we have torrential rain and then excessive drought, and 50% of America is in a drought state now, and when we are getting precipitation, it is excessive precipitation, which adversely affects the bees, because bees don't like to go out in the rain. What could be the likely outcome?
Well, the trend has been for is really very, very dire for managed honeybees. The numbers continue to go down. The strength of the hives that are out there continue to go down, and with like you say, unusual. There will be unusual weather in the mix. You can't always expect perfect weather. We're faced with a critical shortfall of pollinators for the crops that are going to need pollination. And it's really in agriculture, managed agriculture, you have sunlight, water, and fertilizer, and pollination. And these are all essential components to have a healthy agricultural production or a healthy ecosystem. If you put up a giant volcanic event and you block the sunlight, you're going to have crop failure. If you pull out the thread of pollinators, you're going to have a crop failure.
Okay, I appreciate your answer. Thank you. Larissa, we don't rely solely on honeybees as pollinators, but also bumblebees, beetles, butterflies, and other wild pollinators. A Monsanto State University study compared insect data from the late 1800s to the present and discovered that after the 1970s, wild bee species started to drop dramatically, as well as bee-to-plant interaction. What risks are discovering that industrial agriculture technology is having on other pollinators, and in particular on with different pesticides aside from the neonics?
Sure. I think it's a good point that our native pollinating species perhaps are declining, and it's hard for us to assess that as well as we can with the managed honeybees. You know, we aren't actively keeping native pollinating species, and it's hard to track those numbers. And so that is a whole other area of concern to these issues with pesticides and their impacts on pollinating species. I think, you know, with the wealth of scientific evidence that has come out just in the last several years alone, even if you look at one of the studies done here in the U.S. at Purdue University by Dr. Krupke, research came out that there were multiple routes of exposure pathways for honeybees, and that in many ways these are also routes of exposure that native pollinators are exposed to pesticides, and neonics is certainly one of them, as you spoke about earlier, and Neil did a great job summing up. Neonics are used on corn, and so the agricultural industry and its heavy reliance on corn and treated seeds opens up these routes of exposure through dust from the planting machinery, and that dust can then settle on soil surfaces and create dust clouds laced with neonics. This is all routes of exposure that native pollinators are likely to be exposed to as well. And I think that just when you think about the crops that we use in industrial agriculture, corn and soybean, and the slew of other pesticides involved in those industries, I mean, there's the potential for these serious chemical cocktails that we might not even know the consequences for. It's why we need more testing and more rigorous regulations and assessments done. We don't really know the full breadth of how these chemicals are all working together, the synergistic effects, and what they're doing to these species that we can't so easily necessarily see the impacts to, like we can with managed honeybees.
Mm-hmm. Just a follow-up question on this. This is a broader question because our entire corporate agriculture model that is promoted by the FDA and the USDA and the EPA and our government is based upon the dangerous myth and the belief that nature can be forced to conform to an industrial model. I have some very serious concerns about this. I'm absolutely certain that Monsanto, DuPont, and other big agri companies are fully knowledgeable about the damage they are causing and the threats their science poses to our food and biodiversity and soil quality and global sustainability. I don't believe that it's any accident that Monsanto has already been developing robotic bees or pollinators. It's no accident, in my opinion, that they purchased one of America's major bee research companies, Biologics, and is working on genetically engineered bees that might be immune to pesticides. And from their business outlook, this is something they must do if we consider the problem clearly in order to keep their industrial model lucrative in the future. So I'd like for each of you now to comment on the idea that we can twist nature to abide by our technological science. And please add anything you'd like to help us understand the larger picture of the big ag and an agricultural model that relies on massive amounts of toxic chemicals. And we'll start with you, Larissa.
Sure. I mean, I think that's a really concerning point, and it's something even Rachel Carson described in her fears about the use of systemic insecticides more than 50 years ago when she wrote Silent Spring. Mm-hmm. And now we're sort of witnessing firsthand the effects that have come about from this unsustainable industry. Farmers are applying pesticides prophylactically, whether they're needed or not, and that's putting an unsustainable load of chemicals into the environment. As far as Monsanto and Biologics purchasing that industry, I think it's a shame. I mean, I would love to see this be done in the public sphere and not be owned by corporate ownership. But I think what's more important than developing GE or robotic bees is that we focus on the bees that we do have right now. We focus on our honeybee industry, and we focus on the native pollinating species that we have, and we protect them. I mean, it's quite clear we have a crisis on our hands. And rather than investing into these alternative pollinating techniques, I really think it's better that we focus our attention on the crisis at hand. And commercial beekeepers whose livelihoods are at stake, certainly we're not addressing the problem.
Thank you. Neil?
Yes, I agree completely with Larissa. We have a huge problem with our toxic chemical industry and the use in agriculture. We have an industrial agriculture approach that is designed to fail, and that's what we're seeing. I think it's not going to survive as is. We need a completely sustainable system of agriculture, food production. I think one of the things we need to do is we really need to raise the public's awareness about how serious this problem is, and because the consumers need to know what's going on. I think we also need to include the stakeholders such as the growers, the food companies, the grocery stores, food co-ops. We need to raise their awareness that we have serious problems with it's not just the collapse of the honeybees, but it's many our interrelated issues with our agricultural production system that is not designed to last. It's going to collapse. And I grew up in the Midwest in the 50s and 60s, and I can remember when we first began to buy strange tasting carrots and tomatoes in the grocery stores, and I asked my mother what happened to our wonderful, delicious, garden raised, tomatoes and carrots and food that tasted so wonderful. I wouldn't eat a lot of that stuff anymore. And years later, I realized, well, it was grown with pesticides. So, and I don't think it's as nutritious. We need to really have a massive campaign to raise public awareness. I know a lot of us support regulation by the agencies, but public pressure and public awareness are critical to get the public involved.
Thank you. Final word from you, Steve.
I agree with what both Neil and Larissa said. I would say from a beekeeper standpoint, we are faced with a catastrophe here, and really I think it's you almost have to look at what other kind of catastrophes can occur that are similar. If you look at like the financial industry, for instance, there was a move to deregulate, and that they would just do the right thing. And I think that the chickens came home to roost that deregulation doesn't work in that kind of an industry. I think the public is largely unaware of, as Neil alluded, and Larissa has said as well, that In essence, we have deregulated the pesticide industry in the United States of America, and the public needs to be more aware that these are economic poison.
Okay.
That's what a pesticide is an economic poison. And you are going out and poisoning things, and the question is it economically sound to do that? And and what are the impacts going to be on the big scale of things? And you have to take a lot of factors into account, and a lot of factors are being kind of...
Okay. We're out of time. I'm Steve Ellis. Thank you very much. Dr. Neil Carman and Larissa Walker. I appreciate all your good work and the work of the Center for Food Safety in Washington and the Sierra Club's Genetic Engineering Committee for helping bring us a greater awareness of something that we're not talking about, the plight of the honeybee and other essential pollinators. How much food will be lost if the bees are lost? I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.